here is a special announcement. Today is Tuesday, and not, as is announced in today's Sunday Telegraph, Friday. And now, a repeat of last Thursday's performance of Monday Night is Music Night.
Listening to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city, with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, inviting you to attend. I'm here for you at RLA at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or lamplight at cambridge105f.fm. Don't forget the dot. And you can find our archives at momentsunderlamplight.co.uk or on SoundCloud. And now for this. That fanfare for a dignified occasion, played by the London Fanfare Trumpets, is here to help us announce that this show begins Series 4 of Evening Under Lamplight. Series 1 appeared on 209 Radio from August 2008 until the station closed in February 2010. Series 2 began when Cambridge 105 took over the community radio slot in Cambridge in July 2010, and ran until December 2012, when, frankly, I ran out of steam. The show came back again with Series 3 in July 2014 and was dedicated to going through Walt Whitman's Song of Myself, coming to its natural end last month when we attended to the final parts of that long poem. So it seems natural to start a new series now. But what will be the focus of this new series? Oh, you have to do Dante's Inferno, someone said to me, and yes, of course I have. And so, Dante's Inferno it is. A long journey to the center of the earth and out again on the other side of the world. That's what's in store. I don't expect I'll cover the whole thing, how could I? But as we go through the various regions of hell, we'll look at some of the interesting things there. We've covered many of the areas of the Inferno already in earlier shows, but I see no problem in repeating in part some of what's already been said. So stick around as we begin this evening under lamplight, Dante's Inferno, the first of three large sections of his Divine Comedy. And you'll be pleased to hear that unlike Whitman's Song of Myself, Dante's Inferno has a plot. It tells a story, and what a story it is, and what great characters appear. But now, again, trumpets, please. Here they comes. Thank you. And now, before we get to the poem itself, let's spend a few minutes attending to some background material. Dante lived in what I suppose we can call the late Middle Ages, from 1265 to 1321. Italy at this time consisted of many small political units, often as small as one city. When you have all these small units, you can expect a lot of strife as they all jostle for more power. And to this was added the culture of revenge. If one party beat another party in a battle, that second party would not rest until it had scored some marked success against the first. This back and forth, of course, ensured that there would be a perpetual state of unrest. All these different political parties tearing Italy apart. Well, let's not get into them here. We'll discuss them when it becomes necessary in order to follow what's going on in the poem. If you remember the opening of Romeo and Juliet with the incessant fighting between the Capulets and the Montagues, well, then you have a sense of this world. Dante himself, belonging to the minor nobility, took part in these political struggles in Florence, his beloved native city. This political activity would inevitably involve him at some point or other on the losing side. And this happened in 1302, when he was in Rome on a mission to the Pope, and while he was away, the opposition party took over control of Florence and exiled Dante on charges of corruption, something Dante always denied. Over the years, Dante made several efforts to have his sentence removed, but he never agreed to the harsh conditions under which he would have been allowed back to the city. And so he lived for almost 20 years in exile, traveling around Italy, staying for various lengths of time with different aristocratic patrons. In the third main section of his Divine Comedy, set in heaven, the poet Dante has his ancestor Cacciaguida predict for him the pains of exile. You shall be forced to leave behind those things you love most dearly, and this is the first arrow the bow of your exile will shoot. And you will know how salty the taste of others' bread, how hard the road that takes you down and up the stairs of others' homes. That's very poignant. How hard it is to have no home yourself, but each night to climb the stairs of someone else's home. And yet, without a settled place to work, and of course without a computer for research and storage of notes and drafts, nevertheless, Dante wrote what is one of the two or three greatest literary works in the world. Not just great, but intricately complex. The exile began in 1302. The Inferno was probably not made generally available until around 1317. Not really published, since there was no printing yet, but read in manuscripts that people copied and passed around. Such a feat is just incredible to me. Well, it's time for a wee break, and I suppose an appropriate song here is Woody Guthrie's I Ain't Got No Home, though the guy in this song has lost his home because of natural disasters to his farm, as well as the impersonal financial system, and all the rich guys behind it. Dante lost his home, however, because of political intrigue. That's perhaps harder to bear.
I ain't got no home, I'm just a roaming round. Just a wandering worker, I go from town to town. And the police make it hard wherever I may go. And I ain't got no home in this world anymore. My brothers and my sisters are stranded on this road, a hot and dusty road that a million feet have trod. Rich man took my home and drove me from my door, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Was a farming on the shares, and always I was poor. My crops I lay into the banker's store. My wife took down and died up on the cabin floor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore. Around, it's mighty plain to see this world is such a great and a funny place to be. All the gambling man is rich and the working man is poor, and I ain't got no home in this world anymore.
So there was Woody Guthrie with his own homeless problems, perhaps the poor farmer's equivalent to Dante's political exile from his native city. And let's remember, too, that one's city was also one's country. Now back to Dante's Inferno. Most people have heard of this poem either as some sort of computer game or through a Dan Brown novel or just through its casual appearances now and then in popular culture. But I assure you that the actual poem is much better than anything you'd have thought it was going to be like. No, it's not just I who assure you. Generations of readers have been caught by it. And more recently, most of my students have been fascinated by the poem. And just the other day, at lunch at the Chisholm Institute in the Scottish Borders, I was telling the person sitting next to me at lunch about the Divine Comedy. He was an educated man, but had only heard of Dante's poem, never really engaged with it. But after 5 or 10 minutes, he was saying, I'd never realized it was like that. And he was hooked. Like all the rest of us. So, as Robert Frost almost said the other day, I'm just going to let out my passion for this poem. I won't be long. You come, too. On the practical level, I don't know how fast we'll move as we go through Dante's Inferno here on Evening Under Lamplight. Perhaps we'll do one canto per show, perhaps we'll pause and spend more time on a canto or less. There are 34 cantos in the Inferno, each canto running to about 140 lines, more or less. I'm not going to read the whole canto, as I had read the whole of Whitman's Song of Myself. I'll just pick out some selected items for us to look at. Well, let me give you a synopsis of the overall story of the Divine Comedy. I'm not going to spoil anything for you. We don't read this for the plot. There's not really any suspense or surprises for me to spoil. Dante journeys through hell, climbs up Mount Purgatory, and rises through the heavens until he has a divine vision. That's all. A happy, not to say blissful, ending, hence the comedy. Or, with a little more detail, here's the story. The action of the Divine Comedy takes place over 5 days, from Good Friday in the year 1300 to Easter Tuesday. The Inferno opens with Dante finding himself lost in a dark wood. The episode we'll attend to this evening under lamplight. He suddenly comes across the great Latin poet Virgil, who tells him the only way to get out of the wood is to go down through hell and out the other side. And so the two of them begin their journey, Virgil guiding Dante along the way. Now, Dante's hell is divided into three sections. But first comes the section we looked at the other day, the pusillanimi, those who never made a choice between good or evil. Then the three sections, those who have taken good things to excess, such as sex, food, and money. These are minor problems compared to the much worse sins that come afterwards. First, those who have been violent towards others, violent towards themselves, and violent towards God. That includes violent towards the natural world as well. Then there's a huge drop to the third section, deeper down in the pit of hell, meant for those who practiced fraud. Fraud, it turns out, is the worst sin for Dante, for reasons we'll discuss in due course. No? Okay, I'll tell you the reason now. What concerns Dante most is community. People living and working together in mutual respect, support, and cooperation. This requires, above all, good faith. We have to trust the people we're living with, or else there can be no community. And fraud undermines this trust. And it does so in many different ways, which makes this the most fascinating part of the Inferno. There's simple fraud, people who try to defraud us, but actually, any reasonable person knows to look out for these people. Pimps and prostitutes, hypocrites, politicians, flatterers, whom Dante finds immersed in a huge pool of shit. Their flattering tongues ruined our language, turning all beautiful human communication into shit. And many other fraudsters, too. The lowest part of hell, however, is devoted to fraud complex, containing those people whom we would not expect to defraud us, friends, relations, allies, disciples. These souls, Dante finds, lie frozen in ice in the pit of hell with Satan, a ruined, monstrous imbecile, drooling in the middle. Dante and Virgil then climb up from the center of the earth to the mountain of Purgatory on an island in the southern hemisphere. Here, the souls of the people who have been saved can be cleansed of all the things that have defiled them in life. Political leaders who wanted to live a good life, but the pressures of office kept them too busy. People who turned themselves around later in life, but still have to work off some of the things they'd done earlier. People whose weakness led them in wrong directions against their will. At the top of this mountain, Dante discovers, is the original Garden of Eden. And here Dante meets Beatrice, the lady he had been in love with since he was 9 years old, his poetic and spiritual inspiration, who has been dead and in heaven for a number of years. It is she who takes Virgil's place and leads Dante up through the heavens until he finally comes to the Celestial Rose, a kind of plenary session for all the saints in heaven who come together in joyful community. And so the poem ends. Among the characters Dante meets are political and military figures from the recent past, Dante's grandfather's generation and more recent. Then, too, he meets figures from classical civilization, both real historical characters and characters out of fiction like Achilles and Ulysses. Dante seems to have no problem in mixing together real people from the past with fictional characters, and no problem in mixing up classical Greek and Roman characters with characters from the Bible. You'll see how this works as we go on. But primarily, at least for us here, it's a great story. And I hope to tempt you further, here's what Thomas G. Bergen wrote about the journey through the Inferno. Virgil's statement at the end of the Inferno that we have now seen all is a fair assessment of the wealth of the literal narrative. The promise of the early cantos has been fulfilled. The pace has never slackened, has indeed accelerated. The story is crammed with action and variety. The poets have come through no less than 21 carefully identified areas. Dante has seen 128 sinners specifically mentioned by name, not counting the vast armies of the unnamed, and has had conversations with 37 of them. He has met 30 monsters and 5 hybrid creatures. He has had 2 boat rides. He has ridden a centaur and a winged dragon. He has 2 fainted. He has been exposed to excessive heat, bitter cold, strong winds, fearful sights, terrifying sounds, and foul odors. To this catalogue of physical trials must be added a complete stock of emotional and psychological experiences. He has felt compassion, pity, scorn, resentment, anger, vindictiveness, courage, and even, once in a while, a touch of amusement. And all these emotions are superimposed on the constants of terror, wonder, and, importantly, lively curiosity. Nor do the pilgrim's own experiences exhaust the mind of the narrative. T.S. Eliot well says that the tale of Ulysses, regardless of its moral or symbolic interpretation, is a well-told seaman's yarn. We may add that Francesca's, by the same token, is a moving love story. Pierre Delevingne and Guido da Montefeltro recount behind-the-scenes tales of intrigue in high places. From Farinata, we get the inside story of a great decision. From Vanni Fucci, a thief's detailed confession. Caccianamico, Bocca degli Abati, Bertram de Born, even in the compass of the few syllables allowed to them, hint at other vicissitudes of humanity in action.
Time to resign from the human race. Wipe those tears from your lovely face. Baby, wave to the mane in the old red caboose before all hell breaks loose. Before you go, love me some. I'll give you all of the dreams you can use before all hell breaks loose. When he told me I'd never be president, he said adopt a Korean, kill you a moose before all hell breaks loose. You poke fun at my cowboy shoes. You said they look just like big canoes. Now it's time for the chosen ones to choose before all hell breaks loose. Turn out the lights, honey, turn on the news. God save the queen and the kangaroos. And what kind of rubbers did Joseph use before all hell broke loose? Time to resign from the human race. Wipe those tears from your lovely face. Baby, wave to the mane in the old red caboose. For all hell breaks.
Kinky Friedman, leading us in an odd sort of way into our engagement with Dante's journey through hell. Now let's get started and see what we find. I have to start by reading the opening lines in Italian. They are perhaps the most famous lines in Italian literature. Not perhaps, they are the most famous lines. Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita mi ritrovai per una selva oscura che la diritta via era smarrita. Okay. There are many translations available to us, but I'm going to rely mostly on Mark Muse's translation, which is clear and close to the Italian original. Robin Kirkpatrick's translation is more nuanced, but for all its excellences, or because of its excellences, I'm not sure it's the best for people just coming new to the poem. So here's how Musa translates these opening lines. Midway along the journey of our life, I woke to find myself in a dark wood, for I had wandered off from the straight path. So the poem begins in the middle of the journey of our life. The poetic convention found in the Bible and followed by medieval writers measures the span of the human life as 70 years, that is, 70 years. So midway through life will be the age of 35, the age Dante was in 1300, the year the poem is set. Dante the poet was in his 40s when he wrote the poem, but the character Dante, let's call him Dante the Pilgrim, the hero of the poem, is 35. That's the literal meaning of the middle of the journey of our life. But now, what sort of metaphorical interpretations suggest themselves? Is this a poem about middle age? About the time when we wake up and reassess our lives and have our midlife crisis? Well, but, you know, middle is a vague word anyway, and it doesn't have to refer specifically to the 1 year in the middle of the allotted span of a lifetime, but to any sort of middle condition. A place that is not the beginning and not the end, just all that mess in the middle as we make a journey or work on a project. You get married, that's the beginning. You get separated, divorced, or widowed, that's the ending. All the rest, I suppose, is the middle, the time when we settle in and are likely to lose our way, and then at some point, I hope, wake up to our situation and find ourselves lost. And look, we're now in the middle of this discussion, the middle of this week's Evening Under Lamplight. And let's turn this into a station identification. The middle of the journey of this week's broadcast here on Cambridge 105 with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, as we are in the middle of beginning our journey through Dante's Inferno. So it's not so much middle as middleness. The middle is the messy part. That's not one thing or another. The period of change and instability, when we're likely to get bored or lose our focus or just fall apart. What happens at this point? Or at these points, since we experience this middleness over and over again in our lives, perhaps several times within 1 hour? Well, let's attend to some more aspects of middleness. We discussed in two earlier shows, Numbers 84 and 85, in August 2012, the Japanese concept of Ainoma, A-I-N-O-M-A, that space in between. Literally, the Ainoma was a chamber in a Japanese temple connecting the sanctuary and the worship hall. It's the area where the two things merge, but not quite. You're neither in the sanctuary nor the worship hall. And yet you could also be said to be both in the sanctuary area and the worship hall area. As Professor Joel Upton of Amherst College, from whom I learned about Ainoma, as he says, you enter the space between the two to have both neither. The one thing you don't have is either or. It is the space that both separates and joins. Two things are joined but not touching, a place filled with the potential of birth, a place where new things can hatch. New things like a redemptive journey into hell and up to heaven. The Einoma space is a place of paradox, and when we realize this, we know we are in a sacred space, where logic cannot help us, and where we must be open to the unexpected. In Greek mythology, this is called the Hermes field, and we are under the influence of the god Hermes, or Mercury. In fact, Dies Mercurii, the day of Mercury, or Mercredi, or Miercoles, or Mercoledi, well, this is Wednesday, the middle day of the week. Joel Upton insists that Einoma is both symbolic, the chamber in the temple stands for a state of mind, and experiential. We can understand this only by examining our own experience. And so it invites us to examine our own experience, to find a time when we have found ourselves in that middle space, connected to two different things, but also not really connected. Don't stop now to conduct this examination, but sometime later, perhaps, give it a thought. Discover what it felt like when you experienced an Einoma moment. Discover what it felt like when you found yourself lost in the middle of the journey of some part of your life. Oh, and one more thing, please, before we leave this focus on middleness. I just saw posted on Facebook a comment by a friend who was carrying out one of the best activities one can do on Facebook, putting up an intelligent article to share with us, something to help us see the state of the world in a better way, rather than an article on 5 things you never knew about donuts, or why I learned to finally give up my ex and recapture my own heart, or something like that. No, this was an article about Obama. There's no need to go into any detail here, but I just want to bring to our attention what Deborah said in the preface of the article before she posted it. She said, "This is an article I read back in February, but it occurred to me today because I'm sick of the political slogans and one-line platforms put out by literally all of the presidential candidates and the equally simplistic auto-responses by hard-line followers of any of the candidates. This article, for me, shows the importance of getting into the middle of things rather than skating the surface of ideologies." So there's another important aspect of middle. In Deborah's use, it becomes almost the opposite of superficial. Well, come on, who really wants to read all that stuff about any political issue? It's boring. It makes me think, for goodness sake, and that's too hard. So just give me the quick one-liners. Yeah, if that's our reply, then we are in essence refusing to get anywhere. We won't even start our journey for fear of the pain we'll find somewhere in the middle of the journey. But then, of course, we join the pusillanimi in the vestibule of hell, and we know what they're like. So let's welcome middleness, which of course is not the same as mediocrity. Let's welcome it and try to have a little courage to face whatever is going to meet us there. Remember, when Hermes meets us, he will always try to trick us, knock us off our certainty, even cheat or rob us. But the myths insist, he is the messenger of Zeus. He brings us word from heaven above, and our encounters with him always end in good fortune.
Thank you.
Well, there, a little interlude from Gustav Holst with Mercury, the Winged Messenger. Did it feel a little tricksy to you? Did you feel any messages coming through? Well, let's look now at the second half of the first line. We're only on the first line. Il cammin di nostra vita, the path or journey or even the progression through our life. We're dealing here with an ancient metaphor for human life as some sort of journey, literally from birth to death, but there are other ways to see our journey. I know someone who professes, apparently quite seriously, that the person who has the most at the end of life wins. Wins what? I wanted to ask him. It's a good question. I suppose that's not really life as a journey, but life as a race, a competitive race, with a winner at the end. Okay, that's one view. A more, shall we say, mature idea of the journey sees it as moving from the innocence of infancy through our growing experience and back again to that original innocent, childlike openness to life, and as T.S. Eliot put it, know the place for the first time. St. Paul combined the two images, I think, and saw life as a kind of race, though not a competitive race, where at the end we achieve eternal life. This image implies that we must practice and discipline ourselves to perform at our most, at our utmost, during the race of life. But in any case, there is a sense of an end, of some sort of goal, some place we see our life heading towards. And in that case, the sense of cammino that is most relevant is the path. A path leads us along our journey, even if we cannot be clear to what end it's leading us. But for Dante, this right or straight path, the dritta via, has been lost. He's off the track. But wait. For many people, there, of course, is no right path, or at least they've never experienced there being one. Does that mean that Dante is nonsense for them? Are they disqualified from attending to Dante? Or, to put it the other way, can they dismiss Dante as irrelevant to the way they are living their lives? Well, yes, of course. We're always free to dismiss any work of literature. That's the freedom of this whole game. But just because you don't agree with an author's viewpoint does not mean you cannot read the author with great enjoyment and even some enlightenment. You just have to suspend your own views for the moment and try, as I hope I am helping you to do, and try to see things from that author's point of view. What I assume, you shall assume, as Whitman said. What Dante assumes, let us assume also, if only just for the moment we are attending to him. It's like an experiment. We wait to see if anything happens. Who knows? We're just dancing with the literature. And as Danny Kaye sang, with a bit too much schmaltz, but never mind, the best things happen when you're dancing.
The best things happen while you're dancing. Things that you would not do at home come naturally on the floor.
for dancing soon becomes romancing. When you hold a girl in your arms that you've never held before, even guys with two left feet come out all right if the girl is sweet. If by chance their cheeks should meet while dancing, proving that the best things happen while you dance.
The best things happen while you're dancing. Things that you would not do at home come naturally on the floor. Becomes romancing when you hold a girl in your arms that you've never held before.
See what I mean about the schmaltz?
Even guys with two left feet come out all right if the girl is sweet.
If by chance their cheeks should meet
while dancing, while you dance. Proving that the best things happen while you dance.
Well, I sort of want you to ask for your forgiveness for playing that, but we've got to hear all sorts of music, right? We might even dance with that song. Some people might. His voice was very nice. Well, anyway, we come upon Dante in the poem in the middle of the journey of his life when, for some reason unexplained, he wakes up to the fact that he's lost in a selva oscura, a dark wood. There are two aspects to this, first being lost in a dark wood, and second becoming aware that we're lost in a dark wood. I suspect we actually spend most of our life lost in some dark wood, having strayed from the diritta via, the straight path, without knowing that we're lost. Watch how this experience plays out in the following situations. Ah, what shall I do until dinner time? Dark wood. I don't really want to go to the party, but what else is there to do tonight? Dark wood. No, I can't read her a good night story because I have to get this project finished for tomorrow. That's a dark wood moment, too. Why should I extend myself to help him? He made those choices, and now he has to live with the consequences. And that also is a dark wood view. Can you get a feel for the way the speakers of these lines are wandering, lost in dark woods, off the right pathway? Either they simply don't know what to do and seem to be making no effort to find out what to do, or they have their priorities so distorted that they can see only their own needs, not the needs of others. But for some reason, Dante suddenly becomes aware of being in this state. He doesn't tell us how. It's not really all that important, but it is essential that he should awake. How else can you begin your story, after all? Mark Musa translated as Dante having woken, but a more literal translation of mi ritrovai is I found myself, or even we might say, I met myself again. John Aiken Carlyle translated it in 1849 as I came to myself, which can remind us of the parable of the prodigal son, who, when his life was at its lowest, came to himself and turned his life around. I always wonder where he had been before he came to himself. How can you come to yourself? Aren't you always there with yourself all the time? Well, apparently not. The image of finding ourselves, lost or otherwise, suggests that when we are in that spiritual sleep, we're at a distance from our true self. The first step towards setting things right is to get back in touch with that self. Alan Mandelbaum translates this as, "I found myself lost." Playing up the paradox, how can you both find yourself and be lost? It's this kind of playfulness with language that reminds us that we're in the Einuma place, where it's not a question of one or the other, either or, but of both and. This is what we call the gymnastics of the imagination, and Dante limbers us up here at the very start. In fact, you don't really know that you're lost until you're found. And to ensure we spend some time on a playful level, here's the same little lesson taught to us by the Fraggles.
You don't know how it tastes until you try. You don't know how to laugh until you cry. You don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound. And you don't know what you've lost until it's found.
Once I thought the world was made for me.
Once I thought experience was free.
Sing it, Pokey.
Never knew you'd have to pay the price.
Then I found you sometimes pay it twice.
You don't know how it tastes until you try. You don't know how to laugh until you cry. You don't know where you've been until you're homeward bound. And you don't know what you've lost until it's found.
Now I've done some living and I know.
Tell us about it.
Everything you gain is bound to go.
That's true.
Well, then one day my luck just turned around.
I knew that.
The thing I loved and lost is lost and found.
Oh, you don't know how it tastes until you try. You don't know how to laugh until you cry.
You say you can count on Fraggle Rock to give you the serious stuff in the playful tone, or the playful stuff in a serious tone. No, not that way. Just the serious stuff in a playful tone. That's a great song. Lost and Found by Fraggle Rock. So, what do we find when we come to ourselves? We find two things. One, ourself, and two, ourself lost. This journey is one where it is possible to get lost. It's not an easy ride. You can make mistakes and go wrong. Unlike some views of the world, where everything is as it is supposed to be, in Dante's world it's very possible for us to do the wrong thing. In Dante's medieval Catholic terms, technically known as sin. I think our tendency when we discover ourselves lost is to panic, to feel despair. We'll never find our way back. But Dante's myth offers us the reassurance that there is help available, but only if we first recognize that we're lost. That's the essential first step. And what does Dante do once he recognizes he's lost? He tries to find his way back through his own efforts. He comes across a mountain and sees the sun shining high up there. He tries to climb the mountain, but three times he is repulsed by a lion, a leopard, and a she-wolf. Scholars and critics have discussed for centuries what these three beasts refer to, But we needn't spend time about that, except to recognize that trying to go it alone will not work, Dante discovers. Nor will going upwards towards the light. All Dante finds as he faces those beasts is fear, and then as he retreats back into the dark wood, that despair that we spoke about a few minutes ago. I lost all hope of going up the hill. It's back to the dark wood for Dante, lost once more. Now, another mythic image for this dark wood is the wasteland, that state of mind or of soul where we hold fast to those things we know, trying to stay in control, gathering close to us those things that will benefit us and make us feel better. But on the larger scale, we are contributing nothing. Our life is barren, hence the wasteland. And in all the myths of the wasteland, there always comes the herald, the one who calls us out of the wasteland, away from the security, onto the appointed journey that leads back to the right path. And so we find here. As Dante rushes in panic flight from the beasts of the mountain, he suddenly sees a figure coming towards him, rather dim, as if per lungo silenzio, one grown faint, perhaps from too much silence. Psychologically, we could say that this is a figure coming to Dante from out of his own unconscious, not very clearly perceived because Dante has silenced this inner voice for so long. He's open to the voice now, though. Although he's not sure if this is a ghost or a living person, Dante cries out to this figure for help. Save me from these terrible beasts. Well, it turns out that this is not quite a ghost, but a shade, the vision of a soul that has died, or again, psychologically, a shadow figure from deep within Dante's self. In fact, this shade announces himself, in a very indirect way, as being the great Roman poet Virgil. Just imagine what it would be like for Dante, lost, frightened, despairing, to find himself in the presence of the one person from the past who has meant the most to him. "Tu sei il mio maestro, il mio autore," he says. "You are my teacher, the first of all my authors." And as we attend to this moment in the poem, can we ask ourselves who our Virgil would be? Is there some book you read at a formative period of your life, which can then come back to you at a later crisis to offer you guidance in your dark wood? Okay, not necessarily a book. It can be a teacher who meant a lot to you, or a dear friend, or even some enemy whose influence upon you was very strong, strong enough to make a deep impression and to come to you now to show you the way to go next. Whoever it is, just picture how moving it would be to have this voice come to you in your direst need. If you can do this, you are tending well to Dante's poem, what he assumes you are also assuming. Virgil takes the role of the herald, calling Dante out of the wasteland, out of the dark wood. "You have to go a different way," he tells Dante. "You're not going to get out of there by trying to go up that mountain. You're going to have to go downwards first, through hell, that place where you'll hear desperate cries and see tormented shades. But afterwards, you'll see the blessed souls in heaven." A bit of a daunting itinerary, but the end of the path is glorious. And so Virgil now announces himself as the guide as well as the herald. "I think it best you follow me," he says. "I'll be your guide." And Dante consents. Anything to get away from those frightful beasts. "Lead me up to the heavenly heights," he says, even though it means also going through hell. And with that consent, this first canto comes to an end. Then he moved on, and I moved close behind him. And we too now must move on as we come to the end of this evening's Evening Under Lamplight here on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. I don't know if it feels like I did a lot of talking this time, with little real attention to the musical parts of the evening. Well, we had a lot to cover as we entered into Dante's world. Next time, we'll see Dante back out of the journey. that right? He's going to back out of doing the journey. Next time, we'll see Dante back out of the journey. It's too frightening, but he quickly changes his mind once Virgil tells him what heavenly ladies have commissioned him to come help Dante turn his life around. So this is me, Robert Louis Abrahamson, thanking you for attending with us this evening under lamplight and inviting you to return in a fortnight to attend once again.